Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It's June. The solstice is just ahead, bringing with it those crazy, hazy, hopefully lazy days of summer. With any luck, things will slow down a bit, and you might be able to have more time to call your own. I know my listeners have interests that span the globe and cover a myriad of topics. To celebrate all those vibrant and varied pursuits, I've put together a special show. Call them hobbies, pastimes, or passions. We've got a mixed bag of topics and titles that feed into your leisure interests. And we'll be speaking with two very cool artists who've turned their passions into professions and written intriguing books. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the book report. First off on the book report's exploration of hobbies is one that, for many of us, is a passion. Fashion. Looking one's best, putting wardrobes together in a way that accentuates our personal style. From Academy Award winner Diane Keaton comes, let's just say it wasn't pretty, a candid, hilarious, and touching look at fashion, beauty, aging, and the importance of staying true to yourself. Diane, who performs the book, has spent a lifetime coloring outside the lines of conventional notions of beauty. Here, she shares the wisdom she's accumulated through years as a mother, daughter, actress, artist, and international style icon. From a mortifying encounter with a makeup artist who tells her she needs to get her eyes fixed, to an awkward moment at Victoria's Secret with her teenage daughter, Keaton shares funny and not-so-funny moments from her life in and out of the public eye. For Diane, being beautiful starts with being true to who you are. She offers self-knowing commentary on the bold personal choices she's made through the years, and she recounts her experiences with the many men in her life, including Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, and Sam Shepard. She shows how our ideals of beauty change as we age and explains why a life well-lived may be the most beautiful thing of all.
On my 15th birthday, my dad told me I was becoming a pretty young lady. Mom said I had a pretty smile. One of my teachers complimented me on my pretty new dress. I was old enough to understand that pretty was a poor cousin to beautiful. Pretty was the stuff of being friendly, but not being friends. Pretty was the right dress from Bullock's department store, not a beatnik tunic with black tights and a beret. Pretty was Sandra Dee, easy and light. Pretty fades. Beautiful was Natalie Wood, deep, like the ocean. I know this because on the cliffs of Laguna Beach, I cried from the sheer wonder of what I saw. Beautiful makes you want to come back for more. It makes you ask questions. It's vast, unknowable, and magnificent. That's part of its power. It makes you think about the experience it's giving you. That's when I knew what I wanted. I've been chasing it ever since. If we're lucky, we have a long time to consider what beauty means. One thing I know, there is no beauty without pain. Beauty flourishes on sorrow. It's enriched by the knowledge that life is fleeting, sometimes cruel, and often ends without resolution. And that's what makes beauty deep. Marilyn Monroe's insecurity explains her continuing appeal. It wasn't just her pretty face. It was the depth of her sad experience. Without living through the journey from orphan to goddess with a breathless voice, would she have become a legend? In the complexity of her suffering lies the universality of her appeal. How did Picasso come to see the scope of Marie Therese's riveting head and shape it? I'll tell you how. Through loving her, living with her, and seeing her as both ugly and magnificent. Because of his sculptures, Marie Therese emerged as a symbol of unsightly, frightening, even hideous, but also, I have to say, complete beauty. When I was growing up, I had a hard time doing much of anything right. Dad was always harping, Diane, how many times do I have to tell you, don't stand in front of the open refrigerator, you're wasting electricity. Or, Diane, use your noggin. That's what happens when you forget your lunchbox in the car. You don't get lunch. And every single night at the dinner table, for God's sakes, Diane, keep your mouth closed when you chew. There was always something interfering with getting things right. I don't know, a question, the wrong kind, a hesitancy, and always, always the mangling of my sentences, the stammers, the ums, the you knows, the oh wells, the I don't knows. I guess I was inept, inexact, and imprecise. I would never have believed you if you would have told me that this ineptness would help me later on, but somehow it did. And I made my way. Now, Mom, on the other hand, taught me there was beauty in the imperfect. She would jot down words of wisdom and leave them on my desk. Things like, you don't have to be perfect to be beautiful. Walk in power. Find a reason to love yourself every day. Only you can decide if things are right or wrong. Buy yourself a gift for just being you. Honor yourself, Diane. You deserve it. Laugh at your friend Leona for making fun of your face. Ugh. When I was a senior at Santa Ana High School, these words of wisdom, while well-intended, just seemed stupid. Walk in power. Laugh because someone tells you you're ugly, please. Only you can decide if things are wrong or right. Okay, 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 but how?
We've just heard Let's Just Say It Wasn't Pretty by Diane Keaton. A hobby that's closest to the book report's heart, reading. We'll choose a book currently on the fiction bestseller charts, Gabrielle Zevin's The Storied Life of A.J. Ferkey. The irascible owner of Island Books, Mr. Ferkey, has lost his wife. Now, one of his most prized possessions, a rare book, has been stolen from right under his nose. Do other tragedies await? Indeed. One night upon closing, Mr. Ferkey discovers a toddler in his children's section with a note from her mother pinned to her Elmo doll. Quote, I want Maya to grow up in a place with books and among people who care about such things. I love her very much, but I can no longer take care of her. Unquote. A search for Maya's mother, AJ's rare book, and good childcare advice ensues. But it doesn't take long for the locals to notice the transformation of both bookstore and owner. Scott Brick narrates.
She tells him that she recently switched jobs, so her devices have been screwed up. Also, I've been rethinking the whole idea of online dating, like whether it's really for me. Boyd doesn't seem to hear that last part. Would you want to go out again? He asks. Re their date. For a time, the novelty of the circus had distracted from the fact that they had nothing in common. By the end of dinner, the greater truth of their incompatibility had been revealed. Perhaps it should have been obvious from their inability to reach consensus on an appetizer, or from his main course admission that he disliked old things. Antiques, houses, dogs, people. Still, Amelia had not allowed herself to be certain until dessert, when she'd asked him about the book that had had the greatest influence on his life, and he'd replied, Principles of Accounting, Part 2. Gently, she tells him no, she would rather not go out again. She can hear Boyd breathing. Fluttery and irregular. She worries that he might be crying. Are you all right? She asks. Don't patronize me. Amelia knows she should hang out, but she doesn't. Some part of her wants the story. What is the point of bad dates if not to have amusing anecdotes for your friends? Excuse me? You'll notice I didn't call you right away, Amelia, he says. I didn't call you because I had met someone better. And when that didn't work out, I decided to give you a second chance. So don't be thinking you're superior. You've got a decent smile, I'll give you that, but your teeth are too big, and so is your ass, and you're not 25 anymore, even if you drink like you are. You shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. The gift horse begins to cry. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. It's fine, Boyd. What's wrong with me? The circus was fun, right? And I'm not so bad. You were great. The circus was very creative. But there must be a reason you don't like me. Be honest. At this point, there are many reasons not to like him. She picks one. Do you remember when I said I worked in publishing and you said you weren't much of a reader? You're a snob, he concludes. About some things, I suppose I am. Listen, Boyd, I'm working. I have to go. Amelia hangs up the phone. She is not vain about her looks, and she certainly doesn't value the opinion of Boyd Flanagan, who hadn't really been talking to her anyway. She is just his most recent disappointment. She has had disappointments, too. She is 31 years old, and she thinks she should have met someone by now. And yet, Amelia the Brightsider believes it is better to be alone than to be with someone who doesn't share your sensibilities and interests. It is, right? Her mother likes to say that novels have ruined Amelia for real men. This observation insults Amelia because it implies that she only reads books with classically romantic heroes. She does not mind the occasional novel with a romantic hero, but her reading tastes are far more varied than that. Furthermore, she adores Humbert Humbert as a character, while accepting the fact that she wouldn't really want him for a life partner, a boyfriend, or even a casual acquaintance. She feels the same way about Holden Caulfield and Messrs. Rochester and Darcy. The sign over the porch of the purple Victorian cottage is faded, and Amelia nearly walks past it. Island Books, Alice Island's exclusive provider of fine literary content since 1999. No man is an island. Every book is a world.
That was The Storied Life of A.J. Furkey by Gabrielle Zevin. Did you know that May was National Photography Month? A celebration officially recognized by Congress in 1987. What better time to speak with our next guest, a professional in a hobby nearly all of us enjoy and pursue. Peter Essick is a top National Geographic magazine photographer, named by Outdoor Photography magazine as one of the 40 most influential nature photographers. His focus has been to document human impact on development and the enduring power of the land. We'll speak with him today about his new book, The Ansel Adams Wilderness. Welcome, Peter, and thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
Great. Nice to be here.
What made you decide to concentrate on the Ansel Adams Wilderness, and where is it exactly?
Well, the Ansel Adams Wilderness is in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California, and it's between two national parks, Yosemite National Park and Kings Canyon National Park. And it's primarily in the higher elevations of the mountains, the high forest, and then the area that's above timberline. And the reason I initially got involved in this story was I saw a reprint of a book that Ansel Adams had put out in 1938, and it was a book called Sierra Nevada, the John Muir Trail. And it goes through, the John Muir Trail goes through a portion of the Ansel Adams Wilderness, and it got me thinking it would be an interesting project, also because I had done some of my first photography when I was first learning the craft and of photography in this area.
The photographs in the book are in black and white. Was this in homage to Adams?
Yes, partly it was. Of course, I had thought sort of how to do is, you know, I had been a color photographer for most of my career at National Geographic, but I had started doing black and white photography, even using a 4x5 view camera with, of course, 4x5 film that Ansel Adams used. So I thought about going back to using that approach, but when I thought about it further, I realized that Ansel Adams always would use the latest technology that was available. And so I figured if he was doing a story now, he would probably be using a digital camera, and it opens up some new opportunities for capture, especially low light capture by moonlight. And you can also go a little bit lighter than Ansel Adams did with, he had to have a burro to carry all his extra photo camera equipment.
You know, I loved your explanation of a photograph that Adams would have called an extract, when a photographer captures a portion of the scene in the viewfinder that reflects the emotional response that he felt at the time. Talk about that.
Well, that was the big leap that Ansel Adams made in the 1920s. A lot of landscape photographers up to that time had been on these survey expeditions, and their primary goal was to just go out into the wilderness, take these pictures, and bring them back to the city folks to show what this beautiful country of ours was all about as far as the natural scene. But what Adams believed was that photography was possible to capture the photographer's feelings about the place and the emotions. And so he also used that extracts as far as he used a medium telephoto lens quite a bit, which was not as common as it is today. So he was sort of taking a portion of the scene, and so he thought that the natural scene was primarily shapes, and that the photographer's goal was to make form out of all these shapes, and that was that process of extracts.
Hmm. The photographs in the book are from every season. How long did you work on this project?
Well, I went quite a bit in the summertime. That's the main season there because of the high altitude, and a lot of the passes aren't clear because of the snow. So I did most of the work in the summer, but then I did one trip in the fall, early October. There's one section of the wilderness that has really nice stands of aspen trees. And then I did one trip in the winter where I used some seasoned ski guides, and the two of them and myself, we went in actually on cross-country skiing with all our equipment. And that's quite a different experience than going in the summer. We were probably the only three people in the wilderness at the time, and it's you have to carry a lot of gear, avalanche safety equipment, and so it's a much slower travel in the winter.
Hmm. Many of the photographs in the book are accompanied by wonderful quotes from naturalists and preservationists. For example, one from Henry David Thoreau, "It's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see." How were these selected?
Well, we looked through quite a bit of them, and I sort of came to the conclusion that a neat approach might be to find the quotes that Ansel Adams might have been inspired by at the time. And part of the whole concept was that Ansel Adams' philosophy, his view about nature and wilderness, was still relevant today. And so I sort of went back and I found that a lot of those older thinkers from the 19th century, those older thinkers about wilderness and nature were still relevant today. So I thought that would be kind of a neat way to pair those with the modern photographs.
Peter, talk about the man, Ansel Adams. So much of his life now seems a myth.
Well, this particular wilderness area is associated with the early work of Ansel Adams. When he was in his late teens, early 20s, he had a job working with the Sierra Club and he did these High Sierra trips up into the wilderness. And it was during that time that he developed his love of nature, but also he brought along his camera and started exploring how to photograph the High Sierra wilderness. So I found that the pictures that he did at that time were really beautiful. They're quite simple, and they do use this extract method. But his early work and development and his big leap as far as his landscape photography all came in areas right around this wilderness area in the 1920s and 1930s.
We're speaking with Peter Essick on the Book Report. I want to let listeners know that at the end of the book, you include photographer notes so that others may learn from you. Could you suggest an itinerary for folks who'd like to begin to explore the wilderness but are not perhaps the strongest hikers?
Well, there's an area at the National Monument called Devil's Postpile, and that's the place where most of the people enter the wilderness. And you can drive down to that area, and you can take day hikes into the wilderness on not very difficult trails. And if you want to go up a little farther, you can spend one or two nights and get into some really nice areas right up by the minarets. These 17 spires of metamorphic rock is sort of the centerpiece of the wilderness. And you can get to there if you're willing to go on a one-night, overnight backpack.
Hmm. Well, I think most photographers believe that working for National Geographic would be the pinnacle of anybody's career. What were some of the other projects you did that you enjoyed?
Well, I've sort of specialized in two types of stories. One is these natural landscape stories, and I've enjoyed very much one in Finland called the Ulanka National Park, and one in Australia that was called Fraser Island, the largest sand island in the world, and one that I did closer to home where I live in Atlanta. It was on the Ozark Highlands Trail in Arkansas, and that was another one that I really enjoyed. It was pure nature. I've also done several stories about environmental topics, contemporary issues like climate change, global fresh water, e-waste, Canadian oil sands, and I just finished doing one about the mountain pine beetle outbreak in the American West. So those, I kind of think of those almost as the flip side of undisturbed nature.
And what are you working on now?
Well, I just finished a story about the drought that's happening out in the American West, and especially in California. And that story will be published in October. It was for National Geographic, that was sort of a deadline story. I worked on it just in the last couple months. And I also have a story coming out in December on the Yoho National Park. That's up in the Canadian Rockies. And that's another one of my favorite spots as far as really nice nature, undisturbed.
Peter, I really loved looking at the book, The Ansel Adams Wilderness. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
All righty. Bye. From frantic foodies to casual chefs, cooking is definitely a national pastime. In her bestsellers, Ruth Reichel brilliantly illuminates how food defines us. Now in Delicious, the famed restaurant critic of both the LA Times and the New York Times, as well as former editor of Gourmet magazine, brings us a charming story of embracing your own true gifts. Billy Breslin has traveled from California to take a job at Delicious, an iconic New York food magazine. When the publication is suddenly shut down, the staff, who've become Billy's extended family, must pick up their lives and move on. but not Billy. She'll stay behind in the magazine's deserted office to uphold the delicious guarantee, a public relations hotline for complaints and recipe inquiries. What she doesn't know is that this boring, lonely job will be the portal to a life-changing discovery. Billy finds a hidden room in the magazine's library where she discovers the letters of Lulu Swan, a plucky 12-year-old who wrote to the legendary James Beard during World War II. Lulu's letters lead Billy to a deeper understanding of history and the courage one must draw upon to face adversity. Julia Whelan performs the book.
Back on the second floor, I went into Jake's office, trying to decode his expression. Irritation? Should I not have taken Sherman to the kitchen? Maybe I'd been away from my desk too long? I was just asking Maggie for help with the recipe.
Good idea. Jake nodded. She's a font of delicious information.
But wouldn't it be easier if you gave me the key to the library? Then I could look things up.
And stay away from Maggie.
Jake shook his head.
Not going to happen. In the old days, they had a full-time librarian, but long before I got here, that position was eliminated. The place was a shambles. People'd been taking books and not returning them, or just leaving them in piles on the floor. It was such a mess, we decided to lock it up. And it's going to stay locked until we can afford another librarian, which, he added gloomily, is not likely to be anytime soon.
I'd put everything back where I found it, I said.
I'm sure you would.
Jake gave me a conciliatory smile.
But if I let you in, I'd have to let everyone else in, too. So, no, I'm sorry, you're going to have to depend on the database.
And Maggie, I said glumly.
That's not what I want to talk about. You've been here 2 weeks,
he began, so hesitantly that I got nervous. Was he about to tell me the trial wasn't going so well?
And it's time you tackled one of the most important parts of your job. What do you know about the delicious guarantee?
Your money back if the recipe doesn't work? Jake nodded.
So you've heard of it?
I always assumed it was a gimmick.
Oh, it's real. When the first Arthur Pickwick started the magazine, he wanted to make a splash. It was 100 years ago, and back then everybody was trying to make recipes more efficient. But nobody'd ever come up with the idea of guaranteeing them. The New York Times called it one of the most brilliant public relations ploys of all time. Everybody assumed young Arthur would put an end to it when he took over, but he decided not to mess with success.
Don't you end up refunding an awful lot of money? Jake shook his head.
The truth is, we rarely send anyone a refund.
So it is a trick.
Not at all. The offer's real, but most people can't follow instructions. They think they're making our recipe, but what they're really doing is inventing their own. What you have to do is go through the recipe with them, step by step, and try to figure out where they went off the rails.
That sounds like fun.
I hope you're still saying that a week from now.
Jake handed me a pile of letters.
But that's highly unlikely. As you can see, most of the people who write in don't even own computers, which says a lot about who they are. My last assistant loathed the guarantee.
I picked up the first letter, which was from a Little Rock matron who'd sustained a severe risotto disaster. Jake was right. When I called, it turned out she'd used minute rice. Mrs. Amanda Bienstock had substituted baking powder for baking soda in her cake. Really, what's the difference? She complained. As for the woman whose batter had overflowed, causing enough smoke to bring out the fire department, she'd seen no reason why a recipe for a dozen cupcakes wouldn't fit into a 6-inch cake pan. John Kroger of Boulder, Colorado, was a different case. In a calm voice, he told me he'd followed the instructions to the letter.
When it said to toss the salad, he said earnestly, I did just that. And believe you me, it wasn't easy getting all that lettuce into the bowl from the other side of the room.
I couldn't dispute his point. I promised him a refund and picked up the next letter.
I am absolutely furious about the scallop mousse in the current issue, wrote a Mrs. Cloverly from Cleveland. It is simply vile.
On the phone, her querulous voice conjured up white hair and a pasty body muffled in a voluminous apron.
I have made a great many dishes in my life, she informed me, and this was, without any doubt, the vilest of the lot.
That was Delicious by Ruth Reichel. Speaking of the national pastime, let's preview The Closer, a nonfiction bestseller by Mariano Rivera with Wayne Coffey. Rivera is the man who could intimidate batters merely by opening a bullpen door. He began his incredible journey as the son of a poor Panamanian fisherman. When first scouted by the Yankees, he didn't own his own glove, had never flown in an airplane, never heard of Babe Ruth, and spoke no English. What he did know was he loved his family, and he could throw a baseball exactly where he wanted to, each and every time. With astounding candor, Rivera tells the story of the championships, the bosses, the rivalries, and the struggles of being a Latino baseball player in the States while maintaining his spiritual values. The 13-time All-Star discusses his drive to win, the secrets behind his legendary composure, the story of how he discovered his cut fastball, and the untold pitch-by-pitch account of the ninth inning of Game 7 in the 2001 World Series. Michael Kay narrates.
So Herb has to spell everything out to me. A kid as skinny as a Q-tip and utterly naive. No, you won't be staying in Panama. When you sign with a big league organization, the deal is that you move to the United States. You go buy some shirts and underwear and a cheap suitcase. You get a work visa and try to act as if you know what you're doing when you're filling out the paperwork. You'll be scared and nervous and sad and have no idea how you are going to manage in a foreign country when all you know how to say is, I know speak English. It isn't just daunting, it's terrifying. I try not to let on. I've always been good at hiding my feelings. Weeks pass. The plane ticket to Tampa arrives. Now it is getting real. Now it is time. Let's go, Peely, my mother says. Peely is the name my sister Delia gave me when I was a baby. Nobody knows why. It's what my family has called me my whole life. My father starts up his white Nissan pickup truck. Turbo is our name for it. It's 10 years old, rusty and battered, and not anybody's idea of a race car, but we still call it Turbo. Clara Diaz Chacon, my longtime girlfriend, is sitting between my father, Mariano Sr., and my mother, also named Delia. I throw my new suitcase in the flatbed and then climb in myself, along with my cousin Alberto. My father puts Turbo in reverse, and we pull out of the driveway onto Via Puerto Caimito, the one road in and out of our village, the only road that is paved. All the rest are dirt, most of them looking more like paths than anything you would drive on. We proceed through Chorrera, a much bigger town 5 miles away, and then make our way on a twisty, rutted road past goats and plantain trees and swatches of rainforest. Alberto and I bouncing around in the back as if we were coconuts, anchored by nothing, only a skimpy railing stopping us from tumbling out. I know where we are going. Tucumán International Airport in Panama City, but I am much less certain about where I am going. I'm a high school dropout. I don't even make it out of ninth grade in Pedro Pablo Sanchez High School, a U-shaped building in the heart of Chorrera with 3 floors and a courtyard in the middle, and dogs sleeping wherever they can find shade. It is a terrible decision to leave school, but I get fed up one day and just bail on it, walking right out past the dogs in my pressed blue trousers and crisp white shirt. I iron the uniform myself. I like things to be neat. I'm not thinking through any of the consequences of walking out of school, and I am not getting much direction from my parents, working-class people who are smart but not very familiar with formal education. My last school lesson, and the last straw, comes in Mrs. Tejada's math class. At least I think that's her name, but honestly, I'm a bit fuzzy about that just because I try not to think about her very much. She isn't my biggest fan, and she doesn't try to hide it, glaring at me as if I were the bane of her teaching life. I hang around with kids who aren't full-fledged troublemakers, but are definitely into mischief. It is guilt by association, I guess. One day a few of us are fooling around the back of the classroom, paying little attention to the Pythagorean theorem and a lot of attention to a kid we are giving the business to. One of my friends crumples up a piece of paper and tosses it at the kid, hitting him in the head. "Hey, cut it out," the kid says. "I do no throwing, but I do some laughing." Mrs. Tejada notices. "Rivera," she always calls me by my last name. "Why did you throw that?" "I didn't throw anything," I reply. "Don't tell me you didn't throw it. Now come up here." "I didn't do anything wrong. I am not going anywhere." "Rivera, come up here," she repeats. Again, I do not obey her command, and now she is really ticked off. I am no longer a mere paper thrower. I am an all-out insubordinate. She walks over to my desk and stands over me. "You are to leave this classroom right now," she says, then escorts me out into the hallway, where I spend the rest of math class definitely doing no math.
We've just heard The Closer by Mariano Rivera. Tom Thorsbecken, a.k.a. Thor, studied animation and illustration at the School of Visual Arts in New York. He went on to work at Walt Disney Feature Animation, where he was a mainstay at the studio for 10 years. In 2009, Thor made a resolution to do one sketch a day and share it with an online community of urban sketchers through his blog, Analog Artists Digital World. It's a fascinating area I feel sure you'll be interested in, whether or not art is one of your hobbies. Thor has just published Urban Sketching, The Complete Guide to Techniques. Let's find out more. Welcome, Thor, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
You're welcome.
Exactly what is urban sketching?
Urban sketching is a worldwide phenomenon, partly caused by the internet, where artists are sketching in their given cities and then sharing their work online. I am the Orlando correspondent for a site called Urban Sketchers. So urban sketchers around the world contribute to that site, reporting about their cities.
I happen to know that you're an incredibly talented artist. Must an urban sketcher be talented?
Not at all. There's something called sketch crawls as well, where on a given day each year people gather in their city and travel together from site to site and sketch as a group. And some people bring their kids along to just bring their sketch pads and crayons and draw as well. So there's something unique and inspiring in what a child does. So even if it's raw and unpolished and not refined by a museum standpoint, it's still fun to look at.
Well, two questions from that. Where would someone find out about a sketch crawl, and what tools are needed?
Basically, a pencil and paper is the only tools you need, and the site to look for is just sketchcrawl.com.
Tell us about the Urban Sketchers Symposium. Where will the next one be?
The next one, I believe, is in Brazil. The last one I went to was in Santo Domingo. And that's where urban sketchers from around the world gather and go to classes with other urban sketchers teaching principles of drawing.
And about how many in this community?
There are 7,000 people that are on that at least read the urban sketching site. Probably the number's larger than that.
How did you come to do a daily sketch?
I started doing a daily sketch as a New Year's resolution in 2009, and I've basically kept up with it for 5 years. It's sort of become a lifestyle.
Right. And have you ever sketched outside of Orlando?
Sure. Anytime we're on vacation, I bring the sketchbook. So, yeah, I've sketched wherever we happen to go on vacation as well.
I was intrigued in the book to find that you describe yourself as a citizen reporter. How so?
I tend to be reporting on things that the news networks don't cover, which is people that are doing creative work or inspiring work. So I'm covering the good news, the amazing things people do for their community and creative aspects of what's happening in my town.
In what ways do you think people react differently to a sketch rather than a photo?
I think with everybody having a cell phone and their iPhones, people are sort of becoming immune or bored with the images that they see coming off of people's phones every day, the bad photos. So a sketch is something that takes time to do,
and it's unique. It has some character. It has a gesture to it that a photo just doesn't have. So it's an interpretation, and I think people appreciate that.
How long does your daily sketch usually take you?
It's usually about the length of whatever event I go to. Most events are about 2 hours, 2 to 4 hours. I tend to finish in about 1 hour to 2 hours, depending on how fast or how much light there is, whatever circumstances. You can organize one yourself. You just put a question up asking if there's other people around you that might want to get together and sketch.
Huh. How do you choose the subject of your daily sketch?
I choose by scouring newspapers and internet sites, Facebook as well. People send me invites to things. So I'm looking for interesting events where people gather together and share stories, have drinks together. It's always a large group of people gathered together to do something. It's events.
Yeah. Well, I've read your book, Urban Sketching, and I was kind of fascinated to read that you think some classic artists were, in fact, urban sketchers. Give us some examples.
Absolutely. Van Gogh was definitely an urban sketcher. He was recording what was going on in the Paris and the urban or the rural places where he lived, and he was constantly writing to his brother. So had he been a blogger, I think he would have been blogging and writing about his experiences nonstop. Seurat, he would go to a park every Sunday and sketch people and his surroundings, and then eventually those became larger paintings. But he was out with his sketchbook all the time, just drawing life in the city and reporting on what people are doing in their leisure time and during entertainment time.
You know, your book was really fascinating. It's, as the subhead says, the complete guide to techniques. So you really actually break it down into how to begin and perspective and so on. Talk a little about how you organized it.
Yeah, it's set up basically to have students who might be taking classes break out of the studio and eventually get to the streets. From my background, I spent years and years going to figure drawing classes, and it was when I started seeing the bigger picture of the figure drawing class as opposed to putting isolated figures on a page, when I realized I could put a whole room full of figures on the page and have them all working together. That's when I started becoming more of an urban sketcher, reporting on what is happening in the classroom. So not just drawing the model, but drawing the people drawing the model and their gestures and how involved they are in the process. So from there, then you can basically apply that principle anywhere you go in your city and report on people in the bars or in theaters and the parks. And basically, it's the same principle.
Where is your book available?
It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, any bookstore, if you have a bookstore near you.
What final words of encouragement would you give someone who wants to become an urban sketcher?
Yeah, I'm teaching middle school and high school kids now, and the main point that you have to have is always have a sketchbook in your bag or in your pocket. A pencil fits in your pocket, and some sketchbooks can fit in your back pocket. So if you always have a sketchbook with you, there's no excuse not to do a sketch when you see something that inspires you.
Thor, where can we learn more about you and your artwork?
Yeah, my daily sketch blog is called analogartistdigitalworld.com. And that name sort of comes from the fact that I worked for Disney for 10 years, and then they decided that only computers should be making images. So I'm an analog artist in a digital world.
Got it. Okay. Well, listeners, I want you to know that Urban Sketching, the Complete Guide to Techniques, was really fascinating. Thor, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thanks, Elaine.
All righty, bye.
Bye.
The book report's final salute to treasured pastimes is one that defines me, travel. Into the Moon and Timbuktu, a trek through the heart of Africa, Nina Sovich writes of adventure in faraway places. Nina had always imagined herself leading the life of a solitary traveler. Yet at age 34, she found herself married and contemplating motherhood. Catching her reflection in a window, she no longer saw the fearless woman who spent her youth traveling in Cairo, Lahore, and the West Bank. Unwittingly, she had followed life's script, and now
she needed to cast it out. Inspired by female explorers like Mary Kingsley, who explored Gabon's jungle in the 1890s, Sovich packed her bags and hopped on a plane to Africa. The book takes listeners on a fast-paced trek through Western Sahara, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, bringing to light their vivid textures and flavors. On her travels, Sovich encounters rough-and-tumble Chinese sailors, indifferent French pensioners RVing along the coast, and a close-knit circle of Nigerian women who adopt her into their fold. Amy McFadden performs this lyrical memoir.
Flora and I have this old ritual. I ask him if he loves me, and he says yes. Then I ask him if he loves me more than anyone he knows, and he says yes. Then I ask him if he loves me more than everyone he loves combined, and he says, "Well, that's a bit much." I am, as one would expect, always a little disappointed by his response. He should be willing to give me anything, including being bossed around. I love the exchange, however, because I know he does love me more than everyone he knows combined. Or at least he did then. It had been a long time since I played this old game with him, since before we had gotten married, and our relationship had become so distant and tense. There were so many things I needed the moment I arrived at the hotel on the Mauritanian border. I needed water. I needed to make a friend of the hotel proprietor to ensure that someone would help me find different transport out. I needed a new plan, but I needed nothing more than to ask Florent if he loved me, and then to ask him if he loved me more than everyone combined. After weeks of silence, of one-word emails that simply told him my location and destination, I called him. It was about 7 p.m. in Paris when he answered, and I could tell he'd had a rough day. His voice was scratchy and weak, as though he'd been smoking. I told him about Hamda and the teasing. I told him about the Peugeots breaking down and the Italian aid workers. I told him I was at a hotel by the border that was populated almost exclusively by Mauritanian and Moroccan truck drivers. Then I told him I had no choice but to continue on with Hamda to Mauritania tomorrow, since there was no public transport. I asked him if he loved me, and my heart sank low when he ignored the question.
"You know, Nina, you cannot get back in that car tomorrow. Those men are spending the night together, and they're coming up with a plan. They didn't know what to do today, but they'll figure it out tonight. Do whatever you need to do, but don't get back in that car."
I'm still stunned that he ignored the question, and try again for some emotional reassurance. "Will you come get me?" I ask. "I have $500 on me, and this room costs $10 a night, so I can stay here for a month or so. Longer if I prostitute myself." I laugh a little at the end, as though that were necessary, but I think it comes out sounding crazy because his tone softens.
"Of course I'll come get you. Just promise me that you won't get back in that car."
"I think you're overreacting. Do you love me?"
"Nina, you aren't thinking clearly. Promise me you won't get back in that car."
"No, we worked it out. Hamda called me his sister at the end."
"He didn't mean it. You need to trust me on this."
"What will I tell them?"
"Who cares? Who the hell cares?"
He shouts a little when he says it, except Florent doesn't shout, hardly ever, and suddenly I'm very afraid. So afraid, I consider walking downstairs to the gas station and asking one of the truck drivers to take me north right this minute. "This is insane," I tell Florent. "I don't have a good sense of this anymore. I've lost my judgment."
"Yes, you have," he says.
The hotel shuts off its electricity at 11 p.m., but I can't sleep, and around 3 a.m. I go outside to have a look. It's too cold to be balmy, but the air is clean and the breeze is gentle and steady. In the courtyard, truck drivers are sitting around plastic tables playing backgammon by candlelight. It smells like wet cement and cold salt air. Above me, a purple sky heavy with white and sparkling stars reveals the palest sheaf of Milky Way. It is a stunning sky, like nothing I have ever seen, and I stand there until I am too cold to bear it, imagining for just a moment that I could tip myself up into the air and fly.
That was To the Moon in Timbuktu by Nina Sovich. Readers, I hope several of these titles have snagged your interest. Photography, sketching, cooking, travel. There are a million ways to fill your free time. For more ideas, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for our annual salute to Father's Day. See you then on the next edition of The Book Report.